The Oldie Recordings presents Jonathan Dimbleby on the Battle of the Atlantic, brought to you by Doro, number one in the senior mobile market.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. I have to follow two luminaries, one of whose books I've already read, because I got it for Christmas, and it's wonderful. The other of which, having just heard about it, I am definitely going to read. It's daunting to follow them, even more daunting to be speaking to you. Puts me in mind of the politician, the cabinet minister, who is at party conference, and he's addressing the faithful, and you know what happens, they all stand up like... Yeah, lemmings would do. I was waiting for whatever choice came. And they applaud him, and he walks down, and he receives the applause, and he smiles left and right, and his advisor is walking with him, who probably had written the speech. And he turns and hears a voice just off which says, "Didn't think much of that." He turns to his advisor, you hear, the fellow over there said, "I didn't think much of that." To which the advisor, smooth as they always are, said, "Worry not at all. He's never had a thought of his own in his head ever. He simply says what everyone else is thinking." And that's how I feel at this moment, so I'll be listening out afterwards. Anyway, my subject is the longest battle of the Second World War. It is also the most destructive battle in history. It is arguably the most important battle that Britain ever fought because the survival of the nation was at stake. Eventual victory hinged in the West upon our ability to win that struggle. I say our survival depended upon it. We depended on imports across the Atlantic and from all the other oceans for our food, for our steel, for our special metals, for wood, for everything that allows... Hey, look, I didn't do that while you were speaking. Is that his usual tactic? It is. I once addressed a huge audience in front of, a lot of people behind, and in the front were anarchists who shouted "rubbish, rubbish, rubbish" as one spoke. This is far more effective, I have to say.
I was going to play Menuhin on my CD player, but not being a technician, I've failed. All I've done is to mess up your talk, and I'm very, very sorry.
You
being a professional will overcome.
I'll do my best to overcome. Anyway, survival was where I was. The fact of the matter is that had the U-boats broken the Atlantic lifeline from the rest of the world, and specifically from the United States, as they sought to do, if the convoys had been destroyed in significant measure, we would not have survived. Churchill's successors would have been forced to speak to the Nazis and to sue for peace. So it is a pretty hugely important drama, which I think has been undercovered and not written about enough. More than 3,000 merchant ships went down in the Atlantic. More than 30,000 merchant seamen lost their lives. More than 30,000, that's 3 out of 4 of those who sailed in the U-boats, 3 out of 4 of them died at sea. Such was the intensity with which the Germans fought this battle. Thousands of men who were not soldiers, women, and indeed children, perished in the iciness of cold seas. The conditions at sea, some of you will know about the sea, when it's placid, it is requiring always of your concentration. When it is at war with itself, it is terrifying. The accounts of the storms in the winter Atlantic are horrifying to read. 30-meter waves, ships breaking up, ice on the ships from the Arctic and from the Atlantic bergs, so thick that the stanchion posts of large vessels crumbled, guns were thrown off their emplacements, and many of those ships went under, and people died and drowned very swiftly. There's a story told by one of the survivors who became a very eminent admiral of how he was standing on the deck of his destroyer, driving into a storm, and the waves are so big, they're coming right over the deck of the ship. He is thrown overboard, and he thinks to himself, this is it. The very next huge wave, astonishingly, throws him back, somewhat wounded, on board again, and as a result, he lived to become an eminent convoy commander and then a major force in the Royal Navy. Many people were into lifeboats, half drowned. Those lifeboats, days, sometimes weeks at sea. People in those lifeboats perished slowly, one by one, because they very often, nearly always, lacked enough food, lacked enough water, lacked medical supplies. And when that happened, some just gave up and threw themselves overboard. Others became delirious and threw themselves overboard. Others just quietly died in the bottom boards. It was a pretty grueling, at best, a pretty grueling experience. The advantage shifted dramatically from one side or the other in the first 2 years of the war. In February 1942, after the United States had come into the war, after Pearl Harbor, in fact, the Americans had been supporting the British, of course, before that, not least in the Atlantic, where there was an informal war being fought, the Germans declared war on the Americans, and the U-boats set off for the east coast of America. It was called Operation Drumbeat, and it was excoriatingly successful. In February 1942, Churchill was moved to write to the White House saying, this is appalling. In the last 2 months alone, 60 oil tankers have been sunk or damaged on the eastern seaboard. The reason for his concern, of course, was that we were entirely dependent for our fuel oil on those supplies coming in on those ships. Something must be done. Exact words, drastic action is required. It wasn't taken for the most astonishing set of reasons. The eastern seaboard was very busy, then as now. There were entertainment hotspots all the way down. There were businesses. And the government found it impossible to persuade those people, the local authorities and those businesses, that they should dim the lights at night. U-boats operated at night. There are extraordinary descriptions of individuals, U-boat commanders saying, there we were just off the coast. We could see the headlights of the cars. We could distinguish between the large grand hotels and the low dives. We could see the neon signs, advertisements, and read them through our binoculars. There they were, presented to us. Take your pick. And of course, they did, for at least 4.5 months. The other issue was intelligence. It is widely believed, and I suspect some of you might believe it, that it was, as it were, Enigma, the breaking of Enigma by Ultra Bletchley Park, what won the war. In the case of the naval war, this is not true. It is certainly true that Enigma played a part, but for large periods of time, we were not able, Bletchley Park was unable to decode Enigma at all for the whole of 1942, for instance, because they put another wheel on the rotor of the Enigma machine, which made it so many multiples that you had to unpick that it was virtually impossible. It took a whole year for the team there to do it. At the same time, the German intelligence system, BDNs, their naval intelligence, from 1941 onwards, was reading the traffic, the cipher traffic and the radio traffic going from the Admiralty to the Royal Navy, from the Royal Navy ships to the merchant ships. 30%, 40%, up to by early 1943, 80% of the traffic was being read, sometimes 10, 20 hours in advance, which meant that they were able to take the action required to nullify the attempts by the British to get round the U-boat wolf packs. This was a report, no one knew about it until 1945. There was a secret report written. I think only three copies were made available, and it was very difficult to get hold of. It is now obviously in the public domain. The author of the report wrote, it was an internal Admiralty report, this leakage of information through inadequate codes and ciphers very not only cost us dearly in men and ships, but very nearly cost us the war. The struggle was not only in the ocean. My book, if you like, I use it only in this sense, is something of a soap opera. It deals with both the battle at sea, the human experience, the cost, the military character of the war, the weaponry and so on. It also deals with the conflict at the top, as seen from the relevant war capitals of Berlin, Moscow, and of course London and Washington. There were not only divisions between, obviously, the adversaries, but within as well. I mean, at a certain point, Eisenhower writes of Admiral King, who was the most powerful naval commander in the Second World War, if we are going to win this war, someone has to shoot King. That was the measure of some of the relationships. In the case, the most important of these divisions was actually, however, in this country, and it was between the Air Ministry and the Admiralty. The Germans, most of all, feared aeroplanes more than anything else because the aeroplanes could come across very fast, the bombers. They could either give reconnaissance information to the convoy vessels and the escort vessels, or they could bomb from the sky. And so whenever an aeroplane appeared in the sky, the U-boats had to go under, where they couldn't operate. They operated, they fired from the surface. And this became so intense that Admiral Pound at the Admiralty was demanding long-range bombers. Bomber Harris, at Bomber Command, was saying this was quite irrelevant to the attempts to win the war. Early in the war, this reached such a point, incidentally, that one of the admirals at the time, Second Sea Lord he was, wrote to a friend at the time, this battle between the Air Ministry and ourselves is far more savage than our war against the Hun. Now, Churchill was a great war leader, not only politically, but in my view, far more important than he is often allowed to be as a visionary and strategist who really defined, for better for worse, and actually in the end, I think for better, defined the Western war effort. But he made mistakes. He made a lot of mistakes. His most serious mistake was in relation to these bombers. That's what I strongly believe the evidence compellingly explains. 1940, May, we're being bombarded. His response to that was an absolutely devastating, exterminating attack by very long-range bombers upon the Nazi homeland is the only sure path to defeating Hitler. Now, as I said, these long-range bombers, however, were the only sure way of stopping the U-boat attacks. By early 1943, these had become so acute that Pound was telling the Air Ministry that we cannot escape these U-boats. There are so many of them hunting in packs in what was known as the Atlantic Gap, which was an area right in the center of the Atlantic that only very long-range bombers could reach. These were American Liberator planes. Only in January 1943, by which time it was clear that a potential cataclysm, or so it felt at the time, was soon to be upon us, the Allies, was the go-ahead finally given for these very long-range bombers to be made available. Now, there were other factors as well, but in March 1943, it was the worst month of the whole war, and there was real alarm in the Admiralty. At about that time, the first long-range bombers arrived. By June, to all intents and purposes, they were so effective, along with some aircraft carriers that had also arrived in the middle of the Atlantic, that the Battle of the Atlantic had been won. It continued, the attrition continued until the very last day of the war, when Admiral Dönitz, who had been in charge of the U-boat fleet and was now Hitler's successor as Führer, instructed that they stop their actions. As a result of that, I said at the beginning, victory depended upon it as well as survival. For the first time in the summer of 43, it became possible in practice, as opposed to discussing in principle, which had been going on for over a year between the Americans and the British, it became possible to undertake the landings in Europe, D-Day. It is intriguing that battle in the Atlantic could have been won at least 6, probably 9 months earlier, with all sorts of speculative impacts on what might have happened in mainland Europe, which I explore a little bit in my book. But the essential point of this book is that individuals, top, bottom, everywhere in this astonishing drama, fought a long, bitter, painful campaign in which there were heroes and there were villains, and there were enormous numbers of people in between who did what they were told. And the outcome saved Britain and helped the West win the war. Thank you very much.
The Oldie Magazine Recordings. This is a Radio Gorgeous production for The Oldie 2015.